You're listening to The Bounding Box, where we talk about web development, geo-development, and everything in between.
All right, welcome to The Bounding Box. Today, I got a great show today. I have an interesting one here. I have two guests on the show today. So please, will my guests introduce themselves, tell us who you are, what you do, what's your problem?
Okay, I'll go first. So Andy Green, and I'm a project manager here at Esri. And I work on the base maps team for the Living Atlas. And we'll get into more what that's involved with. But what's my problem? From a work perspective, I'll say making sure that users have the most up-to-date maps and being responsive to their feedback and helping them use the base maps as well.
Okay, and I'm Andy Skinner. I'm on the same team as Andy G. I'm a base map author. I'm in my 50th year as a cartographer, and we'll be getting into a little bit more about where that's taken us. My problem, I'm getting old, and every time I think that maybe it's time to retire, I sort of look across at Jack Dangermond and think, no, I've got no excuse.
Isn't that the truth, right? Even like right now, I'm already thinking like, oh, okay, how many more years do I really got left in me here? But I'm just like, you know, I'm just gonna keep going. Yeah, and you're right. You look at like, you know, someone like yourself or Jack Dangerman and stuff like that, or other folks even around Esri and stuff like that, and like, no, they're still going. So hey, I've got no excuse, right?
Yeah.
So I actually started working with the two of you a long time ago, when the vector base maps first came out, and we needed a vector tile editor at the time. We didn't have one, not like the nice editor we have today. And I made that little JSON editor. I think I might have done it for Plenary at a Dev Summit. I can't remember what it was, but you saw it and you were like, okay, that's a let me have access to that. I want to try it out. Right. So for a while that did work for a while. It was buggy for sure. It wasn't perfect, but it got the job done, which was nice.
It is. And to let you know, I still use that on a regular basis for our updates.
Nice.
Because of the access. Yes, it gives full JSON access, which we don't have in the vector tile style editor to get the header information. And it really allows us to do some behind-the-scenes testing before we release it to production. So it's still going strong.
That's great to hear. I didn't know that. Yeah, that is cool. So, like Andy, you said you have a Andy S. I'm sorry. And so, listeners, I'm going Andy S. Andy G. Yeah, here because we got
it's been confusing right through our lives.
So, Andy S., yeah, you've had this for like 50 years or so, and then I know Andy G., you've got, I know, quite a bit of history behind you as well. How have the two of you seen the web and the emergence of like Google Maps like that kind of impact mapping in general and how people actually use maps today?
Well, I mean, I guess we were in it at the start, both of us. We first met up at Penn State, but we were at a small company in Pennsylvania that became MapQuest back in the day. So yeah, we were there when that all started up about 95, I think, was it, Andy?
Yeah, I think the original launch was February of 96, so you know, leading up to that, sure.
Yeah, I remember sitting in a meeting where they said that they were going to take a risk on trying to launch this mapping service on the web, and I don't think any of us realized what was going to happen with it.
Yeah, and it kind of bore out of a print product that essentially I was hired at that company to really, you know, work on at the time, early 90s. It was called Reader's Digest Travel Guide USA. And it was a 1-to-1 million scale map of the United States. That was the main database that was broken up into page size maps. And then Reader's Digest provided the content for travel locations throughout the U.S. But that 1-to-1 million database was like the test database that MapQuest used to build their online map. And it stayed online for a while as their intermediate scales for the base map. And then they licensed other data from, at the time, Navtech, which is here, and Teleatlas, which is now TomTom. So, you know, through the years, the same kind of players have been, you know, in my life from the work perspective, come and go in terms of working on the data. But yeah, it all started from a print product in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, which once you tell people that, it's like it's not a Silicon Valley startup or anything like that.
That's just, I do remember when MapQuest became popular back in the 90s, because before that you would keep and I know a lot of other people did, kept like paper maps under the seats in their car, and you would navigate the indexes and stuff. Then once like MapQuest was out, you just print your directions at home. You set the paper map, take it with you and stuff. But it was way easier than trying to navigate that guide on the road while you're doing stuff, right? You just hold out that, have someone read the printout for you, which is a lot easier. And like they said, this is before you could even have the stuff in your phones. You had to still print out your directions and stuff like that. And there was no phone access really at the point. And like now today, I mean, everyone just, you know, busts out their phones and get their directions. They ask their car to tell them, hey, I need to go X, Y, and Z. Tell me how to get there. All right. So,
well, and we were both working primarily at that stage on road atlases. We created a road atlas for National Geographic. And then I moved in 2000 across to Rand McNally, and I was working on the Rand McNally road atlas along with other stuff. And Rand McNally was sort of other end of the coin, because they did a lot of online stuff, but they missed the boat to some extent in terms of, you know, MapQuest stole their thunder in terms of the online stuff. And so we struggled with trying to keep the sales going on some of those products. And ultimately, they started to go away. Towards the end of the 2000s, most people who had a road atlas in the car used to use it just as a backup in case their GPS system or whatever they were using broke down. True. Now, I'm not sure. Most of the generations coming through now probably don't even know what a road atlas is.
And the Rand McNally ones were like, they weren't like, no, the whole city type thing. They were like for specific like trips you would take, something like that. If you were going to go to Yosemite or something like that, there'd be a Rand McNally travel guide to help you with that, right?
Yeah. Well, we had the National Road Atlas, which covered all of the states. And then we had street maps as well. I mean, we did all levels. The Thomas Guides that are well known in California were owned by Rand McNally when I was there. So we did a lot of that work. But by the end of the 2000s, it was really beginning to, I'm not saying going away because they're still producing it, but it was beginning to really ramp down. And that was when I moved to Esri.
What kind of considerations are there when you make those kind of maps? If you're making like a road atlas map, right, that someone's meant to like navigate while they're driving type of thing, based on what people are using today with like the base maps stuff like that, where it's more of a, you know, you might just be trying to find highlighted features on the map or like what stands out in base maps today. Well, how's that like differ?
I think one of the things is the fact with the web map you can do the multi-scale mapping, and to some extent a print map multi-scale mapping, you know, one page is a state, the other page is a city, but the true, you know, getting down to real street level on the web, you know, it just gives you that much more flexibility of being able to display more features. So, you know, okay, at a smaller scale, you can get away with not showing things because, you know, as a user zooms in, and they will zoom in, that they can actually access that content. So it's really being able to put a lot more content on the maps and being able to structure it in a usable fashion.
It's a fundamental difference in terms of the cartography for people working in the industry, because our work used to be one view, how much information can you jigsaw into that view? And it was like a jigsaw at times. You know, you'd spend time just moving stuff around to try and get that extra label in somewhere. And then when you get across to a web map, base maps in particular, which is what we work on, then you're taking stuff out because there's no point in having it at a specific scale, because you're just one or two clicks away from being able to see it in a much better context.
Yeah, I remember.
So it's a complete switch around.
even just in the stuff I used to do, just making maps, like, you know, be focusing on trying to get as many labels as you can in, because you got to print that map. Then you have insets, so you can get a bit more labels. Like, people always wanted more labels and stuff to highlight things. So the, go on.
Now it's like people do ask for label lists because they can bring their own data, and in the on ArcGIS Online system, that's kind of the beauty of it, is the combination of operational layers from the user in conjunction with the base maps. And, you know, that's how we kind of structure what base map styles that we're building, what we're publishing, is that collaboration with our user base.
Now, are all of our the Esri base maps based off of the community base maps?
There is a good portion of data from communities, and a community can be anything from a country down to a college campus or even a complex of buildings.
Okay.
So that's it's really that combination, and the base for Esri vector base maps is a commercial source, the TomTom data. And then it's supplemented by community maps, the community maps program. And that, you know, it's an active program, it's growing, and they really do provide a lot more information. And for the purposes of Esri publishing the maps and hosting it on ArcGIS Online, and then these communities can build their own maps and apps off of the data that go into the base map and have a lot more functionality than them having to support that system for their operations.
And I do know too, we also host the OpenStreet base maps as well as VectorTiles as an Esri service. We do have to kind of clean that up a little bit, right? So it's not so much data per tile. Is that correct?
Yes, so we are conscious of performance of the maps, and OpenStreetMap does have a lot of data, a lot of building footprints. You know, get into a lot of amenity points, so we do some filtering of it. But for the most part, the core intention is to replicate as much as possible, because users who are accustomed to the OpenStreetMap really are looking for that. In that base map, you know, the richness of that data.
Yeah, I do remember when that vector base map came out. It was, yeah, I know the team, the Maps SDK team, JavaScript was trying to, like, you know, get the performance and stuff up to par with that, because it was a lot of compacted data per tile that was coming in.
Yes, yeah, we still do that type of testing, and if there are tiles that exceed kind of the limit that we're setting, we'll look into ways to push data at different scale levels. And, you know, so the leaf tile occurs at a larger scale and then makes it a little bit smaller as it breaks up.
Now, there's a lot of Esri base maps that we have, and there's some interesting ones as well that aren't just, like, you know, a navigation or street. There's like the Nova dark base map, there's the colored pencil and a newspaper one. How do those come about? I mean, is someone just, when you guys over there just said, I'm going to have some fun today.
We've got one person working with us who just quietly works in the background and comes up with these. That's Cindy Prostak. And she does some amazing stuff. And she's responsible for a lot of those. I've done some of them as well, but she's really the key to it all. What's changing is that the base map is becoming just the start of it now, partly because of the work that you did and what we do with the Vector Tile Style Editor now. The base map is only a starting point. We're really encouraging people to get in and start working with them themselves, so they get something that's a bit more attuned to what they're trying to do and more integrated into the map. So, you know, things are changing all of the time.
Nice.
Yes. And so, like, Cindy on our base map team, and then other people like John Nelson within Esri, you know, really pushing the limits of what is possible and showing users. Sure, you can use sprites on lines. You can really expand the sprite use. And they were really designed to kind of push the limit of what is possible with the vector base maps. And, you know, really just showing that creative nature of our teams. Yeah.
And coming into the vector base maps, and we still have raster base maps that we serve, everything correct?
Yes. Yeah, we for the map portion, those are in mature support, but imagery as a raster base map, and a lot of times people don't may not consider the imagery as a base map, but you know, it really is. That's going to be raster.
Yeah, it's the ultimate base map in a lot of respects.
Yeah, I remember when we first started with Vector Tiles, I was doing sessions with Craig Williams and stuff, and he had that term, raster is faster, as vector is corrector, right? So,
yeah, and there's really, I know you could do some styling on the rasters through the API, but, you know, really that benefit of customization on the vectors, you know, I think at least from a cartographic standpoint and user customization standpoint, the vectors come out way ahead overall.
Yeah, they're nice because you don't have to, you still have to cook the vector tiles, but with the raster tiles, you have to cook them for every respective scale that you're kind of interested in, and yes, so that they look good. With the vector, we can draw them, even if you didn't cook the tiles at a particular scale, we can still put them together and make them look nice, right?
Yeah, and that's the other thing, is that we're cooking one tile set, and then all the styles are referencing that. In the raster world, we had the full set of street map tiles and then a duplicate full set of topo style maps. So it was really hard to expand the style set because just the amount of time to create the multiple versions. So with vectors, you make one and then you make one tile set, and then the variations come in through the JSON styling.
Now we just, recently had the new vector-based maps release, I believe within the past year or so, the new base map styles. And I mean, how often do we update base maps like that?
So the Esri base maps are updated. Right now, we're at about a 3-week cadence, and that is, it's different parts of the world based on the data that is getting updated. So at some part in the world, we're refreshing the data and publishing that and doing a lot of feedback edits. We have a feedback service that users can report issues on, and that'll get put into our database. But we are on a regular cadence, and we are responsive to doing updates.
We also have localized base maps, correct? So if you're, depending on the country that you're in, something like that, you can set the localization for the labels and everything on your base maps?
Yes. 40 different languages. It's the ones that ArcGIS Online supports. And it's in the data. We utilize Esri's localization services, and we have those translations for a lot of features in the maps, and then we do have the styles for those 40 different languages.
That's cool. That's very useful. I know when I would go to Dev Summit in Berlin, you get a lot of really good feedback on that for our maps.
Yeah, and on the developer side of things, they have the language, the language picker, or they consider it worldview, through the API as well. So that's a little bit different than what we're doing on the online base map side, but it's utilizing the same content that we're cooking into the base maps.
I still think stuff like that is very cool, just be able to cook all that different information right directly into the tiles of the base maps.
It really is. And I think Andy S, has exposed some of that content that we do cook in there with. He's been responsible for the National Geographic style, and they have their unique boundary ribbons, and we have a latitude longitude grid that not a lot of maps use, but we cook that in, and users can expose that. And Andy has exposed that through like the Nat Geo style and some of the other styles that he works on.
Yeah, that feeds back into what I was saying about people getting in and adjusting these maps themselves. There's a lot available in them that they may be not aware of that they can add, they can augment the map with. And of course, just as importantly, they can take stuff out. You know, if one of our maps is too busy, they can get in and start switching stuff off and really focus in on what's important to them.
That's neat. I didn't know we had the latitude longitude grid in there that people could turn on and stuff like that.
It's almost more of like if you find it in one of the styles, you just have to copy that block of code into your custom style that you're doing. So in effect, all these styles are kind of like libraries of information that you can compile and build your own custom style from it. And that's really the beauty of the vector style editor. I think that's really been a kind of a game changer for users. If they just want to change one color, that's important to them, or like Andy said, remove one feature, they can do that. And or if they want to go full blown, and I think Andy, you've actually used that style editor to completely redesign a style, as opposed to just doing pure JSON editing.
I'm doing it all the time. I mean, very when I do build maps themselves, I don't. Other than base maps, I don't build that much. But when I do, I never take the base map as I find it. I always go in and say, "Okay, what do I need to change?" And it's really powerful in that respect.
And really, the good thing is that you can change the style all you want. You're still being connected to the core tile set that gets updated every 3 weeks or so. So, you're getting the benefit of your own style plus the benefit of updated data.
That's neat. That is super useful to have. And I know every now and then people will give us some feedback. I'm like, oh, I don't think this information, whatever, is correct on the map, something like that. But like you said, there's a way they can get that feedback back to the team to look into it, right?
Yes, definitely. And that's, kind of not the full blown OpenStreetMap experience, but it is kind of that local knowledge that, we can only do so much. People are going to know what's around their area. And if things change, even with the Community Maps program, until it gets into the contributor and then the contributor getting it to us, there is that lag. But if people can go in and provide that feedback, we can be more responsive on it.
It's always been a problem, I mean, going way back in cartography, that users tend to think of maps as being definitive. And cartographers are only human. We do make mistakes and we know it. And quite often what happens is when people find a mistake on the map, it's usually at the local level, and they'll be indignant about it. Because they think, this map's supposed to be perfect. What's happened? And we have to sort of smooth it down and say, okay, we'll get that changed as soon as we can. And we do pretty well. As we speak, we've just had the Baltimore Bridge collapse.
Oh, wow,
And
yeah.
that should be appearing. Andy, how quickly is that appearing now?
Yeah, next week. So we were kind of in the middle of a release cycle, but we were able to, and that's the beauty of the vectors as well. We were able to patch our vector tile package and get a kind of a almost a real time update out there.
Wow, I had forgotten about that. That's true. Jeez. And that feedback process, that's something that people do via online. Is there something there that they would do that feedback?
Yes, there's a couple of base maps for image, feedback service for imagery, for geocoding, and for base maps. And it is something, even if you go through Esri Technical Support, there, that's one thing that they're aware of too, to provide to the users as a pathway. Emails are great, but sometimes it doesn't get to the right people, or it takes a little bit too long to find its way. But this is like you're literally drawing on the map what the correction is, providing information, and the data team behind the base maps are actively monitoring that.
Oh, nice. And yes, how many iterations do you say it takes you to finish up a base map once you've started one?
Well, we've all got different ways of working. I tend to work from small scale to large scale. And I'll get the primary colors established first, figure out how the map's going to look overall, and then start diving into the detail. And it takes as long as it takes. I mean,
Is a
a
map
lot of the time you're
ever
just trying things out and saying, no, that doesn't work. Let's try something else. And go in a different direction.
is a
And
map
quite
ever
often the map
finished then?
looks completely different to what you expected it to when you started out.
Are your maps ever finished, Andy? There's always something, right?
It's the secret to cartography is knowing when to quit. And we're all guilty of that. We all go in and, you know, we'll work for so long and you just think, oh, there's just that one other thing that I want to change. You've reached a stage where you've got to say, okay, it's enough.
Yep, true, true. I feel that. Yeah, when I was in my degree is in geography, but I actually was more the human geography path and stuff like that. But I do wish I had more focus on cartography when I was in school, especially in a geography program. I thought I would have, but I guess it maybe just depends on the school that you end up going to or something like that. But people that are interested in cartography, like, you know, actually learning about the theory of cartography and like how it all works, what do you recommend to them?
Ooh. It's very difficult to find a cartography course these days. I think it's mostly been replaced by GIS, and cartography is an element of working with GIS. Yeah, there are plenty of good textbooks out there. Ken Fielder's got his cartography book, and there are a lot of others out there. More and more, particularly with what we're providing for people now, there are people who've never built maps before are getting in and playing with it. And maybe the answer is that just get in and play and get a feel for it. And then when you hit problems, start looking around either through textbooks or online and seeing what you can find to answer that and build up the experience.
Nice. Yeah, I have found it's difficult to really find material focused on just, you know, on cartography, you know, whether it be color theory or, you know, just you know, what types of line work to use. I mean, I have an old cartography textbook that goes over like when you use a dashed line, when you use a dotted line, type of thing like that. But I mean, it's probably a good 20, maybe 30 years old at this point.
It's all about experience and figuring out what works. And I'd encourage anyone to get in and try it these days because the tools are out there.
Nice.
You don't have to wait for anyone else. You can get in and just start playing with it and seeing where it takes you.
So on that same path, what kind of tips and tricks do both of you have for listeners out there? Anything at all? Doesn't have to be related to anything we talked about if you want.
Andy, I'll let you go first.
Oh, thanks. from a mapping perspective, it's like I really, you know, as our user conference is coming up, it's like I really enjoy kind of meeting with our users and seeing what they're doing with the maps, because, you know, to some extent we're building these maps and making the content available, but it's what the users are actually doing with it. And some of this stuff is, you know, really amazing, what their apps that they're putting it in. As we get into 3D based maps and things like that, you know, that just really opens up the opportunities. And kind of like what Andy S said was, you know, get in there and explore, because, you know, the way that online is set up and with the learn lessons that we have, you know, there's a lot of things that are out there, and people have a lot of data, and they can, a lot of the data is spatial, and they can just really experiment with it and see where they can take it. You know, a lot of people on our team, the Living Atlas team, you know, are building things with policy maps, and it's just that combination of really demographic data or really any type of data, environment data, that you can visualize, and it really makes a difference in the story that you're telling. And maps, and that's one of the reasons I got into maps, is like they really do tell stories and experiences, you know, whether it's personal experiences that you've had through travel, or just, you know, kind of giving you a better understanding of the world. And that's that was one of the things that drew me into geography as well, is just that exploration aspect of maps.
Okay, from my point of view, I guess all I'd say is enjoy the ride, looking back at it from, you know, 50 years on. I don't know what I expected when I went into maps. Where I've ended up is nothing like what I expected. It's been quite a wild ride, and enjoy it while you can.
Awesome. Well, thank you, gentlemen. I really appreciate you coming on today. Having the two Andrews on is fantastic.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, folks.
Thank you for listening to the Bounding Box today. Please subscribe for more content.